Hello, and welcome to Fairy and Fantasy Class 20. Today we finish, mostly, with Andrew Lang, concentrating on Rapunzel, Snowdrop, and the tantalizingly Tolkien-relevant The Enchanted Ring.
Okay, good morning. My iPod having finally permitted me to sign in. I want to start off saying a couple things about the papers. I want to say a few things about the papers. First, let me start with a suggestion. I think I've suggested this before, but I wanted to suggest it again. Remember, the overall thing that I want you to be doing in this paper is to be looking at, you know, I talked at the beginning of our Lang discussion, you know, that we're jumping forward 500 years. And in essence, what I want you to be doing in this paper is to be looking at what is still the same, what has changed in the 500 years that we have skipped, okay? So I want you to be sort of comparing and contrasting the 19th century stuff with the medieval stuff. But I don't want mere generalizations. Don't just kind of, you know, bloviate, to use one of my favorite verbs, about, you know, like the medieval things in general and the Victorian stuff in general. In fact, if you don't use the word Victorian at all, I'll be happier. My suggestion, therefore, what I would like you to be doing is I would like you to be talking about specific things. I would like you to be doing some specific analysis. I would like you to choose something specific to look at. My suggestion, my recommendation, is that you try to do a careful analysis of no more than two works. Three might be possible. More than three would be really pushing it and likely get really superficial. That is one of it. The paper is short. Again, we're talking about a 3 to 4 page paper, so you're not going to have much time to do more than really, like, choose either, you know, a particular and narrow theme, you know, in Lang and in the medieval stuff and compare them, or whatever. You can choose a particular story which has some interesting overlap and connect the two. But the more specific is your focus in the paper, the better off it's likely to be, and you're likely to be, I would say. Christine?
Did you say two stories per period or total?
Total. Total would be my recommendation. Total. We're 3 to 4 pages. There's not much room. I'm not saying, please understand, I'm not passing a law. I'm not saying it's what you have to do. It's just a suggestion. It's a recommendation. That would be the simplest, cleanest thing to do. If you do more, I mean, if you were trying to look at like three different Lang stories and connect it to two of the different medieval poems, I mean, if you just break that down, you know, break your 3 to 4 pages down there, you're talking about like one paragraph on each one, and you're unlikely to be able to do much more than some really superficial analysis that way. So that's why I recommend against that. I can imagine a topic which says, you know, I'm really interested in this one particular element, the representation of waterfowl, for instance. It's a joke. There aren't so many waterfowl in the medieval stuff. But anyway, you get the point. I mean, if there's some particular thing, some particular element, which therefore would bridge more than one story, but it's sufficiently focused enough that you can talk about that element in a couple different stories without having to, you know, sort of be backing up and waving your hands vaguely at stuff, that's also fine. Simpler, cleaner, easier. Choose two stories between which you can see some connections, do some comparison and contrast, draw some suggestive conclusions. You're unlikely to be, I say suggestive because you're unlikely to be able to prove anything. It's not like the conclusion of this paper is going to be, therefore I have definitively demonstrated that this is the difference between the medieval period and the 19th century. I mean, you're not going to be able to do that. But you can, what you can do in a paper like this, in analysis like this, is to say, Here is a suggestive thing that we can notice. You know, here is something which, you know, is definitely kind of worth looking at. This seems to point at a thing. That you can do. Some kind of definite pointing at a thing, I think, would be excellent. Any questions? One other thing you will notice is that, unlike with Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, I have this paper due at the end of our discussion of Lang, rather than prior to the last day. There are two advantages to this. One is that you will not have the experience, which many of you have reported having with Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, where you write your paper, come into class the next day, and feel like I'm asserting that your paper was wrong in retrospect. The other advantage that you will have is that you will have today, and today only, as your final opportunity to bring up in our discussion together some of these ideas that you might want to be looking at. It would be a good way to kind of float some of these things. Because in just a minute, I'm about to ask a pretty open-ended question about themes that you might be interested in talking about in the Lang stories and any connections you may or may not want to make with the medieval poems. So I just thought I would tell you, I think that would be an excellent opportunity for you to raise some of these things that you're thinking about and kind of, you know, see how it goes. So, what were some themes that you noticed or have been thinking about in the Lang stories and the medieval poems that we've read? Thoughts? Yeah, Dorian.
Well, basically, the nature of affairs changed. I mean, I obviously knew the ones of North. The North were colder, more law, and basically they're more violent.
I think that's a really interesting point. It's something we talked about right at the very beginning. On the first day when we came in to talk about Lang, it was the first thing that anybody said. You know, the representation of the fairies is different. You know, when the first time in the stories that we read, when we see, you know, the fairies show up as the invited guests at the party for Sleeping Beauty, you know, sort of the christening party that they're having, that's, you know, we were noticing what a different world we seem to be in there to what we were in the medieval poems. Now, after 15 stories, we haven't talked about that in a while. Where do you think we are now? What kind of trends do we see? What kind of continuities do we see just in the representation of the fairy characters themselves, the actual fairy figures that we meet? One thing that I noticed is the kind of casual identification of them, right? The number of times that we've seen people or the narrator say things like, and thus he knew that she was a fairy, right? Oh, you must be a fairy, right? That's, nobody really talked like that. Neither narrator nor character in the medieval poems really talked like that. One small observation. Kat, what were you doing?
I was noticing that there was quite a dichotomy. There was either like, the fairy is very good and she helps out, or she or he is evil, then an ogress or an ogre witch and wants to eat or kill the children.
Good. Yeah. Even to sort of add to that, the kind of subdivision that we seem to have, that is the witches and the giants and the dwarfs and the ogres, in addition to those characters who are simply identified as fairies, I was about to say complicated the landscape, but I'm not sure that's true. Simplified in some ways, right? I mean, when you meet an ogre, you know what you're getting, right? When you meet a remarkably beautiful and wealthy woman in the forest in a medieval poem, you don't necessarily know what you're getting or what has gotten you. Will?
I'm kind of interested in that. I think it's kind of the same point, but that was more intention there. Instead of just the beautiful, the incredibly beautiful people, you get like promises and people who are with different physical characters, different types of fairies.
Yeah, and Rumpelstiltskin is a good example. You know, here I was just sort of suggesting that in a sense we have them sort of pegged into different categories, which does kind of make things easier, but not trivial, and I think that's important to remember. Rumpelstiltskin, he's bad, sort of, but he's not like ogre bad. He's not like, I have, like, you know, the irresistible desire to eat children. He may, in fact, be planning to eat the child, but we don't know for sure whether he's eating the child, and his actions are not simply malevolent. And certainly we get a lot of variety in dwarfs, especially. I mean, I say of all the like subcategories of vaguely humanoid but magically based characters that we've met in these stories, dwarfs seem to me one of the most complicated. Right? We've had some really good ones, some really cranky ones, some really uncertain ones. Jordan?
One thing I've noticed is that a variety of ways from the classification of fairy types and what to the changes in motivation, fairies have become a lot more mundane. They become part of this world. like even in the medieval period, I was thinking in terms that have not been invented yet, because beyond the fields we know, they were Bastion about theory. It was like this other world that they visited but never fully entered. And I don't think that's the case at all in most language stories. The theories are coming here, they'll be coming up out of our world, and they're not coming up being part of theirs.
Yeah, even when we see the overlap, like with Lanfal, right, where he can basically summon her anytime he's alone and he calls for her and she'll come, there's still this sense of like this kind of parallel world that they're in. The two worlds don't touch until the moment where Triamor herself humbly, self-sacrificially enters it, right, and displays herself.
That is reaching out to her.
Yes.
He's not summoning, he's reaching out, he's calling for theory.
Right.
Not just to arrive, but he's alone, so he might as well be going out there from any perspective.
Right. No, exactly. Whereas I agree the fairies are, in a sense, far more integrated, at least in the way that they're talked about. Now, that's not like they're totally integrated. Like, you know, you've got, like, the fairies setting up their shops on the street with the blacksmiths and the cobblers. But I agree, there isn't that same sense of mystery. And in part, one of the things I would point to, though, it might seem a little bit silly at first, is just the change in location. That is, we don't only meet fairies in the middle of the forests anymore. They're all over the place. We still do sometimes meet them in forests, like in Beauty and the Beast, like in blanking the last, or like in the Enchanted Ring, right? But we don't. That it's not exclusive. There's not this. Their society, their culture is completely separated from, and you have to leave humanity behind, and at least temporarily, in order to find them, or in order for them, well, okay, not necessarily in order for them to find you, ask Herodotus about that, but anyway, I think that that's an interesting shift. They're just kind of hanging out, again, like the party for Sleeping Beauty. Erin?
I found it interesting, going off the parallel worlds, the only mention in all the stories that, all the Lane stories we've read, that we've gotten of another world is in Jack and the Beanstalk, where it says the castle is on the borders of Fairyland. And that's like, that's the only direct reference we have to a Fairyland that might parallel Lanfal or Orfeo.
Yeah, no, I agree. The only other thing I can think of, and it's not exactly Fairyland, is the remote distance from which the good, kindly fairy is summoned back for the assistance of Sleeping Beauty when she falls asleep, and they send for her, and like the guy with the 7-league boots goes like striding away across the earth to where she is, and then she comes, you know, whipping back in her chariot drawn by dragons. She's far away, but not in the same way. She's geographically removed, and you have to go really far to find where she's hanging out. But I agree that even that is not at all the same. Doesn't feel at all the same. Jess?
I feel like to some extent in the medieval literature, we are given enough about each individual fairy that we can figure out where they came from to a certain extent, or what they're supposed to represent or mean, as opposed to like her fairy godmother, a fairy. Like that, oh, I'm sorry, that comes on very quickly for me, and I don't, like, from where, what does she do, that kind of thing. So
yeah.
I feel like it's more specific in the medieval, or more is available to us to understand the person.
Yeah, and it's not like we're given, you know, like the personal background of each, but I agree, we don't get this sense of like, and now all of a sudden, like, the fairy godmother leaps out of the closet. We have no idea. That's an excellent example with Cinderella's godmother. We have no idea where she comes from. I mean, it's just, I mean, yeah. And I think we see that kind of thing a lot. And you know, you can say that a similar kind of thing happens, such as in The Enchanted Ring, again, where we get this sort of sudden, you know, a guy is down on his luck, he has been wronged, and pop, here's a fairy with a magic ring who says, I shall give you this blessing. But even that feels more medieval than Cinderella does, right? She has more of a connection. It makes a little bit more sense. Not that I think Cinderella is nonsensical, but it definitely is operating differently. Mac?
I'd like to go back to the classification of fairies seems as though it might be an implementation on a large scale of the idea that naming something gives you power over it. Like now we've classified all the different members of the fairy phylum.
Right. we're better able to deal with them as equals, and like sort of we see people making deals with fairies, like actual deals in medieval scale. The fairies always set the terms, and if people got the better of them, basically, then they let them.
Right.
Here, it's their fairy.
No, I mean, I think, and yeah, I mean, as you say, even with things like the giants and the ogres, we know where we are, and we know how to, you know, Jack the Giant Killer might seem a strange example of humans negotiating with fairy creatures on established terms, but he is. I mean, he's, you know, he's dealing with them violently, but there is more of, as you say, a sort of a give and take, I think, even between Jack and the Giants, looked at from a sort of a particular direction there. But yeah, no, I mean, I think that that makes sense. Think, for the giant parallel, think back to Sir Launfal. We got a giant in Sir Launfal, right? The random guy from Lombardy who challenges him to a battle who is gigantic, right? Not exactly the same, as we've seen, doesn't seem to be, so far as we know, explicitly connected with Triomor, with the fairy world that Launfal is connected with, but we have had a giant, but who is different, who feels very different, I think, from the lying giants. Jordan?
I interpreted the Launfal giant as one of those tales from foreign parts kind of things, and then the reason he's a knight is because the medieval people assumed everything was knights and, you know, kings. So, like, when you hear about, you know, what was it they called? There was some normal animal, like a camel leopard, and they have no idea what giraffe, like, the giraffe before they had any idea what to call it, there were two other animals.
Right.
And so it's just like, okay, I hear people here are really tall. Maybe they're 15 feet tall and all night.
Right. Though he's also fierce. I mean, in medieval, and this is a sort of a broader theme which goes beyond just these particular fairy romances. Guys who are 15 feet tall and guys who are 2 feet tall in medieval romances do get typecast. I mean, you're not going to often find a 15-foot tall guy in a medieval romance who's just like, I happen to be 15 feet tall, but other than that, I'm a kind, fun-loving, gentle guy. You know, I enjoy gardening and long walks on the beach. Like, they're not like that. They're just not. Normally, they're like, I eat virgins and young children when I can get them. And, I mean, that's... And I prefer to, like, kill knights with my bare hands, like, trample upon them and rip off their heads. And they're not... The guy in Launfal is a little more knightly than usual. In fact, often, and this we can see in some of the other stories of the giant of Mont Saint-Michel, Jack the Giant Killer's first giant, he is often depicted as like the anti-knight giant. Like what he really likes is taking down knights, and he does it in a crude and barbaric way, not in knightly fashion. And Arthur, when he fights him, sort of steps down from regular knightly. They don't joust. You know, he gets down and sort of fights him hand to hand on the giant's own terms. Yeah. But I'm starting to range kind of far afield here. Well, let's get back to Lang. Other themes? Other thoughts? Yeah, Kat, go ahead.
One thing I thought was really interesting is that previously in medieval romances, the fairies kind of step forward to the humans like Triomor does and says, okay, this is how the show is going to be run. Here are my terms. But now with Langs, the fairies only kind of retroactively do that. Like, you just stamped on my flower. You have to give me that child now to make payment for the flower you just switched.
Yeah. Side note. Rapunzel's kind of weird, don't you think? In case you were wondering, I'm not going to be able to explain this very clearly because I don't really know. Rampion is a kind of flower with edible roots. That's why we're making salads out of it. But it is a flower, which I think is relevant. Because, of course, the child is named Rapunzel, which is just the German form of that exact same word, rampion. It's also called the bellflower, I guess, is one of its other names in England. I cannot picture it. I don't know what it looks like. And you'll notice, of course, not only that the name of the girl is after the flower, but the stories are directly parallel, right? We have this woman, witch, mean person anyway, who has a garden of these flowers, which are edible. They're beautiful and edible. And the guy crawls, you know, sneaks over the wall to steal them, and she catches him and says, "How dare you?" And then what happens? She gets the kid, names it after the flower, and then locks it away until a guy starts sneaking in and threatening to steal it from her, at which point she punishes him, right? So I mean, we have this sort of recapitulation of this same story, and even the sort of the interesting way in which he gets punished by her. He jumps out of the tower to escape her and then is blinded, apparently accidentally, by the thorns that he falls into that spike his eyes out at the bottom of the tower. And it sort of seems like, well, that's sort of bad luck. But it's not just luck. This is a consequence of her action. She says, she compares Rapunzel to a bird, right? The cat caught the bird, and the cat will claw your eyes out too. And then he jumps out of the tower and has his eyes stabbed out by thorns, right? Which seems non-coincidental. And then she, the old woman, witch, mean person, completely drops out of the story, and we have the unexpected eucatastrophe at the end where he meets her. Her tears cure his eyes, and everybody, except presumably the old woman, whom we don't know what she's doing, and the parents of Rapunzel, about whom nobody cares anymore, live happily ever after. It's an odd kind of story.
I just feel like the old biddy falling out at the end is really consistent. Cinderella's stepmother in the beginning is very prominent, and then it's not. But I also feel like it's not, like, you're not sitting there wondering. It's like, oh, well, who cares? And I think that's something that isn't necessarily same in what we've seen in medieval art.
Yeah, there are many times that we see characters or elements of these stories that just come in, participate, and leave. And I agree, that's pretty common. And it's, you know, whether it's something as sort of small and incidental as the mysterious fairy duck in Hansel and Gretel, or something as seemingly more significant here as first her parents and then the old mean person. I keep hesitating because it's not, I mean, does she ever do anything magical? Rapunzel's hair, which is sort of the most extraordinary and unusual element of the story, which seems magical, we're not told is a product of her activity. It just grows. Like, we're just told, like, FYI, she had really, really, really long hair. And the witch takes advantage of this. But anyway, there's actually almost no obvious magic that happens in that story. Other than it seems the unknown, and therefore presumably magical, cause and effect between her curse of him and his getting his eyes stabbed out by thorns at the base of the tower?
This is not intended facetiously, although of course it's going to sound like that. Building a tower in the middle of the woods without any architectural assistance. And the reason is, it's not a joke, is because actually when you think about it, in stories like these, the only people who have towers in the middle of the woods are the magical people. It's a sign of you being magical, you dwelling on people nowhere.
No. Yeah, no, I agree. It is a little suspect. I mean, especially if you live in a tower in the middle of the forest that you lock somebody up at the top of, that's not a good sign. You know, and people should ask questions. It's almost as bad as, you know, having a house made of cake in the middle of the woods. That's much weirder. But no, I agree. I mean, that's... Okay, I keep sort of pausing and joking when I refer to her. I don't want to refer to her as a fairy or even as a witch because she's not clearly magical in this, not explicitly magical in this way. But again, it's hard. She's also clearly not just random old woman.
They do call her a witch.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're afraid of her, so there's got to be a reason why they're so afraid.
No, we don't. I mean, again, other than like the blinding thing, I mean, I guess we sort of see like, well, you know, that caution was prudent in the end. Because, of course, we can see apparently what she can do by cursing people. But it's rather a non-element in the story. Duncan?
What about her ability to appear places? Does that mean she just kind of randomly walked in, or I'm thinking, like, all of a sudden she's just, you know, standing by?
I don't think we have reason to think that she's like, poof, here I am. I mean, I don't think so, because we don't see that happen.
Yeah, I was also, that was conditional, too, because I was wondering why she didn't just poof into the tower.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she's got to use the ladder. She's got to climb up the hair just like, well, I was going to say like everybody else. Of course, the point is everybody else isn't supposed to be doing it. But yeah, I mean, it seems to be a genuine sort of like necessary mode of ingress to the tower for her, too. Yeah, Taylor?
I thought in this one that, well, every other fairy tale villain that we've seen in the last story so far, for the most part, it's a pretty grisly end, and that's like the justice hurts, but she does not. She's just suddenly not in the story anymore.
Right, and I agree. That's the one thing that I would say that I would sort of put against just the point that you made, which I think is a very good one about people falling out of the story and are not having a problem with that, or it seems like we're not supposed to have a problem with that. It's less common for, like, the antagonist of the story, when there is one, which there often is, just to sort of vanish. Sometimes they're dispatched conveniently and quickly, but, you know, as, for instance, when, like, in one line we, you know, burn to death the washerwoman and her daughter in the Black Bowl of Norway. You can't stop me from making allusions to it, even if you guys don't want to talk about it. But yeah, no, I think that is interesting. It's not that the villains always get punished, but it is unusual for them just to vanish and us to stop talking about them. The story kind of moves past her in a way, which doesn't normally happen, I think. This leads me to one of the main questions I had, or one of the main themes that I was thinking about after reading these stories, sort of the way that magic in general works. That is, when people do a thing, whether they're fairies or witches or whatever, when something happens, which is magical, obviously magical, are there different sort of, first, are there trends that you see in how that happens in Lang, how we see that in Lang stories, and differences or similarities with how we see magic happening in the medieval stories? It's a little unkind to ask like three big questions right in a row and then say, well, let's start with the Lang stories. Themes of how magic is used in the Lang stories. Let's begin there. Robbie?
Well, it's kind of a general observation, but in some of them, the fairies tell you to do the magic first, and then you screw all the work after, you know.
Can you give me an example? What are you thinking of?
The enchanted ring.
Okay.
She makes him and tells him what to do with it, and he still burns by the rings and
throws
his life, and then
good.
Follows him in a cave for like decades or something.
Yeah, yeah. We can definitely see a connection between, for instance, the enchanted ring and Aladdin's lamp, right? Where you have sometimes magic which is at the will of human, is placed at the will of human beings. And then what they choose to do with it determines what happens. Now, like to some extent, we can see some magic things being placed, like in Lanfal, for instance, right? When he's given things like the magic bag of gold, and the horse, who never openly displays magical attributes that we know of, but he's still a fairy horse, and I don't know, like he's not, you know, we don't get. though it would have been cool. Things like we see, Gifra is to other squires what the horse is to other horses. It would have been kind of cool to see, like the fairy horse in action. But anyway, she gives him magical things to do with as he will. And especially I would point to the bag of gold, right? Because that he uses. And how does he use it? Lanfo? The magic bag of gold?
He uses it for charity.
Yeah. He becomes the most generous guy around. Given an unlimited supply of wealth, he gives it away all over the place, right? That's a good choice. Just as when the good brother is given the enchanted ring, he does good things with it. And when the bad brother is given the ring, he does bad things with it. It's one of my favorite elements from that story, right? And the fairy comes, you're down on your luck. I shall bless you. Here's an enchanted ring. And they're like, ooh, the bad brother, he's very bad. I will curse him. I'm going to give him the same magic ring, right? That's a really evocative moment, I think, in that story, right? That really sort of points to very interesting, but pretty clear moral, I think. Kat?
One thing I thought was interesting with Lang is that almost all the magic is linked to items, and most of them are food. Like the Black Bull of Norway, she gets three different types of fruit. Snowdrop has the apple. There's the flowers from the 12 brothers, which you can... Never mind, you can't eat lilies, they're poisonous. and then there's the beans. Like, all of these could, in theory, be a food item.
Yeah, yeah. There is a food trend. That is interesting. When you think of the things that he takes, the items that he takes from the castle, they're mostly wealth related. Like, you've got the chicken and the eggs, but that's not a food thing, that's a money thing, right? And you've got the harp. One of the harp is different. But there's definitely a trend there. Jordan?
Something that's true in both the Lang stories and the medieval stories is that magic almost never has a direct or overt element. The closest we get is transformation, but magic never strikes people. It never forces them to do anything. It can place curses on them. It can show them alternate means of doing things. It can be an item that allows them to act in a way they would not otherwise, by becoming invisible. But you never get magic just like directly affecting the world, per se. Except for transformation, which are kind of pretty direct. But also, in some ways, indirect, because if you stop the person you are, you used to be under it, and once they're broken, broken.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think that the counterexample I would give, which I don't think amounts to a disagreement, is Aladdin. Thinking of like the palace that he makes and stuff. That is, he makes stuff happen. The genie makes stuff happen.
Clarification. To people. The world can be changed sometimes, especially in terms of wealth. But people are never ultimately directly affected. It's always about people's actions.
Right.
As much more than the magic is when the magic affects them.
Right, and their choices. No, I mean, think of, for instance, Beauty and the Beast, where we see all of this magic around Beauty, right? Surrounding her and her being served and her, even, her whims being served. Like, even that moment where she's like, gosh, I wish my bedroom were right next to this room, and oh, look, there's a door into my bedroom, right? I mean, it's, but yet, the one thing that is never touched, as you say, is herself. It's still, at the end of the day, her and her own will, which has to be turned to say, I want to marry the Beast. And that's the entire focus of that entire situation. What do you think? Does that seem to work? Can anybody think of sort of counterexamples or further illustrations of that? Where magic is not used, the premise being that magic is not used to dominate people or to control people or to, even curses. Like, we've got the fairy who's going to curse Sleeping Beauty to death when she pricks the spindle, which is, of course, then altered by the second blessing, or the subsequent blessing. But even that...
It's the spindle, not the fairy.
Right, right. Yeah. I prophesy that she's going to prick her hand on the spindle, get a nasty case of sepsis, and die a swift death thereafter. Possibly, possibly. Jess, what were you thinking?
Just talking about magic, not necessarily dominating. I know I keep going back to Cinderella, it's just like my go-to fairy tale. the fairy godmother, it's all to enhance Cinderella, but it doesn't really have any negative effect on anyone else.
Yeah, and enhance is a good word, too. It doesn't change her. It just alters her circumstances and conditions. I mean, like her clothes and her attendants. So let's take some rats and some mice and transform them, make them into her attendants. But she still is who she is.
Yeah, she's not saying you are terrible and an idiot. Let us make you smarter.
Right.
It's something that's already there that she's just making better or possible.
And even when we have something about a person being altered, as when, I almost said, what's her name? Then I remembered, oh yeah, she doesn't have a name. The girl in the Three Dwarfs story, when the dwarfs say they're going to bless her with becoming more and more beautiful every day, right? That seems to be, based on everything else we've seen from her, simply, we're going to make visibly manifest outwardly the character that she already has. It's not, we're going to transform her into a good person. It is, she is a good person, and we are going to make that obvious to everybody. The things that she says are good things. And therefore, we're going to tag that by having gold literally dropping out of her mouth. Right, to sort of literalize the metaphor that already is true. Right, we're going to make her grow more and more beautiful, meaning to other people, she's going to seem more and more lovely and more desirable. Again, not an alteration of her, just helping people to recognize what already is. And of course, the same is true in reverse of the bad sister, right, or the bad stepsister in that case. Like, okay, she wasn't having amphibians leap out of her mouth previously, but that is, again, a sort of a literalization, an outward literalization of what was already happening to some extent. That is, her words were ugly. The Toads Union would not appreciate this story, of course, but I think we have to accept the fact that toads are supposed to be repulsive. Apologies to toads, but that seems to be the emphasis there. Okay?
What about the princess from Sleeping Beauty, then? The fairies directly change her. They make her the most beautiful person in the world. The next that she would have the wit of an angel. Apparently, angels are very intelligent. The third that she would have a wonderful grace in everything she did. The fourth that she would dance perfectly well. The fifth that she would sing like a nightingale. And the sixth that she could play all types of music. So these are direct changes to her personality.
In infancy. So we have no way of judging whether this is enhancement, to use Jess's word, and the parents seem to enter into it with that understanding, right? Like, if we play our cards right here, we can get like a, you know, super daughter out of this, right? Which they kind of do, temporarily anyway. I'm not sure what to do with that, and mostly because I can't think of any other examples that are like that. The rest of them seem to fit into that pattern, but that's a good example. I don't know. Yeah, Christine?
I think whether or not there are direct changes to the character that it seems like the magic plays the role of helping some sort of fulfillment of desires on the protagonist, because by the beginning, we're automatically made to side with them, not just because we start the story with them, but because, like, the male characters, like Jack, like you know, heroic, eager, and then the female characters, all, you know, very kind and obedient, and they're just seemingly so wonderful that it's gotten to the point, at least for me, that I've just stopped caring about lack of explanation. So at the end of Rapunzel, and I'm just like, yes, the magic tea. Like, I was perfectly fine with everything being okay in, after two sentences. Like, I was just like, awesome. So, like I just sort of, like, realized, like, the fulfillment of those desires for these characters was, I think, or is, I think, the big thing for the magic in there.
Yeah, and the fulfillment of desires. Yeah. Bringing that back to Sleeping Beauty. Okay, here we go, Kat. I have a counter-argument. Ready? Here it is. If we just objectify the daughter, we're fine. That is, it's the desires of the parents that are being not manipulated but fulfilled. And if you think about it, Sleeping Beauty didn't do anything through that entire story. Like, other than her brief and sort of kindly but unmemorable exchange with the random old spinning woman with the contraband spinning wheel up in the attic or whatever. But I mean, other than that exchange, we get almost nothing from her. The story is all about other people's attitudes towards her and thoughts about her. Her parents, first, all the way up through her being cast into sleep, and then the prince afterwards. And she becomes a sort of an object in the story, operating on the same level as her quasi-allegorically named children. Remember the boy and the girl, like, you know, name,
Dawn and Day.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yes. But as I said, she's still completely passive. I mean, the whole ogress mother-in-law sequence at the end, she's an almost complete non-character in that. She, like, it's her and the two children who are, like, the victims, and it's the servant in the castle who gets them out of it. She doesn't have, you know, her, like, moment of resourcefulness or anything. She's just, you know, the deer is offered up instead of her, and then she's off living with her children. She does almost nothing. She's the focus of the prince, and she's the focus of the parents in advance. So if we, like, don't think of her as a human being, then we're fine. No problems. Okay, it's not a totally satisfying counter-argument. But that does kind of seem to be how it operates. Though that itself is sort of interesting, because there aren't that many other stories that seem to work like that, that have a central figure, like a titular figure, which is kind of a cipher like that, kind of a placeholder, in the way that Sleeping Beauty is in the reading I just gave of it. So maybe I'm paying too steep a cost for that particular reading, but I don't know. Christine?
And I guess going off of my last comment, I think I made a comment of this in the discussion board, but I noticed that most of the villains, like, a couple of them are acting through by jealousy, but most of them just seem to want, like, either wealth or food, to be honest. Like the dwarf in the Snow White in Red Rose, and, what else? Aladdin, that's wealth. Jack and the Beanstalk, the giant, well, he wants food and wealth.
Right, he wants food and gets wealth instead, yeah. Jack does, yeah.
And then, like, for other ones, like, the dwarf in Rumpelstiltskin, supposedly it seems to want food, the ogress in Sleeping Beauty, food. So then,
Even in Snowdrop, right, the bizarre element, the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs Disney film is sort of truer to the plot of that story than most of the Disney films of stories that we've read. I mean, it sticks pretty close, except, of course, for the whole bring back her lungs and liver and I shall eat them with salt, right? That's not in the Disney film. But it's interesting because we get an eating element there too, right? She's not like the ogre's mother-in-law, right? I just have a hankering for, you know, my stepdaughter as dinner, but it's like the now I have totally conquered her and I shall feast upon her lungs. Lungs? Why not lungs? I couldn't get over that in that story. Go ahead.
And for that same story, like the fact that she's just so easily and like quickly tempted by like the queen's, like the comb and the apple, like it's just I found myself being like, no, don't, come on, come on.
Yeah, come on, exactly, right, yeah, the queen.
Just sort of rooting for her and, like, wanting, like, again, just this clash of interests and desires. Like, you know, we could rewrite a lot of these tales in, like, in the perspective of, like, maybe, say, dwarf in Rumpelstiltskin, I think it's...
Yeah, Rumpelstiltskin.
No, Snow White and Red Rose, from his perspective, and maybe like, you know, there's a famine in the dwarf family, and like he really needs this treasure.
That's right. I just gotta make ends meet for my little long-bearded dwarf family.
Then we'd be rooting for him, but we're not, and you know.
Yeah. No, I mean, I do think, and coming back to what you said before, Christine, it is certainly money and food. Money and food. I mean, how many of these stories come down to something other than money and food, right? I mean, that's like, whether we're talking about eating food objects, like Kat mentioned before, having magical food objects, or eating people, right? Either the good guys or the bad guys are eating. In almost all of these stories, it's food and money. Food and money. A very dominant theme. Whereas you'll notice food and money are involved lots of the times in the medieval stories, but not in the same way, right? What does Lanfal get from Triamar? There's food and money involved, but that's not what's primarily on his mind, right? Now, some of that we can say is one consequence of this now being a children's genre, right? That is, the sexual dimension, we're just removing, mostly, not entirely, but mostly, right? But yet, even with Lanfal, it's not down to food and money. I mean, again, you think of the difference between what Lanfal does with the never-ending supply of money when he gets it and what Aladdin does with the never-ending supply of money when he gets it, right? A different world. Final questions? Thoughts?
It being a children's genre, children are much more involved in the more recent ones than the medieval poetry. Like, they weren't ever mentioned at all in the medieval poetry, so they're all over the place in the Lang stories.
Yeah, no, it's true that, and that has a complicated consequence, I think. It is not merely that children become the protagonist of many of the stories, as in Hansel and Gretel. But even when children are not themselves the protagonists, there's still an interest in the story. Even if it's just sort of having children or raising children or something like that, even that is when children become the objects, like the two different give me your firstborn child stories that we've had. Thank you. Have fun. This should be a good time. Next time, we will begin the fantasy genre near its very beginning with the guy with the most awesome name of anyone on the syllabus, by far.
Okay. In the next class, we officially move into the 20th century with the work of Baron Edward Morton Drax Plunkett Lord Dunsany. And if you think I'm going to go out of my way to use his indescribably awesome full name whenever I can squeeze it in, you are absolutely correct. For the next class, read the first half of the Book of Wonder, pages 1 to 26 in our edition. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.